We're talking about so-called long haulers and what it takes to recover from COVID-19. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The medical community hasn't come to a consensus on a definition of recovery that extends beyond someone being discharged from the hospital or testing negative for COVID. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, published a report recently that warned of prolonged symptoms for adults who are hospitalized with the virus. Have you tested positive for COVID-19? What has recovery been like? Do you feel 100%? What do you want to know about how the state arrives at the number of people who have recovered? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Jeff Potthoff is an emergency medicine physician and chief quality officer for UW Health. Dr. Potthoff, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
And we also have Mark Rickers here, digital producer for WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge. He's been reporting on long haulers for WisconText. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Mark, let's start with you. Why did you want to understand and put some parameters around what it means to be recovered from COVID?
Well, the state health authority publishes a number called recovery status. It's actually 86% of the total positive cases of COVID-19 statewide. And started talking about that number, and it just seemed like a lot of people. And like we wanted to know what that experience of recovery meant, especially having heard a lot about all the different kinds of recovery that people are experiencing. I mean, if some people are getting better within a few weeks and some within a few months, how do we decide what recovery actually means?
And you talked with someone named Adrienne Lathan. Can you tell us about her recovery road, her stages of COVID?
Sure. So Adrienne was hospitalized early in the pandemic. She nearly died in the hospital, sadly. But she did get better. She was put on oxygen for 30 days. She was basically sent home on oxygen, and then she was kind of at home just trying to get better from symptoms of difficulty breathing, fever, a lot of respiratory and fatigue symptoms. But one other aspect of this that she told me about was just survivor's guilt. Her father passed away while she was sick, also with complications from COVID-19. She had other family members and friends. And so she's kind of working through the mental toll of having experienced all that loss as well.
Dr. Potthoff, why are the recovery stages so different for each person who experiences this virus?
Yeah, we're still trying to figure out why that's happening. So if you get a common cold, you don't expect to be sick for, weeks to months. Same with the flu. You might be sick for a week and then you slowly recover, but not a whole lot of people have these long-lasting symptoms. We're still learning more about COVID-19. We know that people who have more severe acute illness are the ones who are more likely to have these lingering symptoms. But this is one of the things that worries us about COVID-19 is it's a brand new disease. So, I can tell someone who has hypertension what their long-term risks are, what's going to happen. Someone with high cholesterol, we don't know what to tell people with COVID-19 because some people who had it early on in the pandemic are still having these long-lasting symptoms. We're just not sure how long they're going to last, if they'll ever go away, what that'll look like. It'll take us years to know what this actually looks like.
We're learning, too, that these long haulers, as they're called, or long-termers, they are starting support groups with each other, and that they're concerned that they're not believed, that their symptoms are lingering, and that they're being told by the medical community or that their doctor that they should be fine, they're recovered. What is the discrepancy there, Dr. Potthoff?
I think the discrepancy is early on. The only thing we can compare COVID to are other respiratory illnesses, and typically people do fully recover from those. Now, I think with the additional reports that are out now, both what the CDC is saying, there's a study from King's College. These are showing up in all of the medical journals. Providers aren't going to call these people, faking it or overreacting. There is enough data now where this is a real phenomenon. There are people who are having a very difficult time recovering from COVID-19. They tend to have similar symptom sets. So this is a real thing. We don't fully understand it, but to say that it doesn't exist, I don't think we can say that anymore.
We're discussing how coronavirus patients recover differently from the virus. We're talking to WPR digital producer Mark Rickers and Dr. Jeff Potoff from UW Health. You can join in with your experience with COVID and what your recovery has been like. Questions about the recovery process at 800-642-1234. Mark, explain for us, how do state health officials track whether patients have recovered from the coronavirus and how they arrived at this recovery status?
Well, they're basically assessing for further infection risk. So they go by three criteria. They go by either if your respiratory symptoms have resolved. So basically you're not showing a fever, you're breathing okay, you're actually starting to feel a little bit more normal. That you've quarantined for up to 14 days, or that it's been 30 days since your positive test result. And that last one is kind of the difficulty because a lot of patients, they'll get a positive test result. The state will follow up with them. They'll say, I feel pretty terrible, but I'm doing okay. And then the state probably won't contact them again. So that at a certain point, you have to assume that that person got better. That's not necessarily meaning that that person's totally lost. They're you know, probably talking to their doctor, but, in terms of the state numbers, that person then shows up as recovered.
So it's somewhat difficult and subjective to figure out what that number really is, what that 59,000 and, where it is today, about 59,000, really means for Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a pretty good, when you look at that number, it's easy to think, oh, but the majority of people who've caught this in the state of Wisconsin have already gotten better. But there's a fairly good chance that many of those people are still experiencing symptoms of the virus.
Dr. Potoff, which patients typically benefit the most from hospitalization with COVID?
Yeah, I'd say the number one reason people get hospitalized for their COVID-19 is the respiratory difficulty. So the shortness of breath that gets so severe that they're not getting oxygen to their tissues. That's a dangerous condition to be at home with. That's probably the number one reason that we end up bringing people into the hospital for COVID-19. Now, it might be that just putting some supplemental oxygen, a small amount of oxygen on these people, and keeping an eye on them for a couple days is enough. But for some of these people, they'll quickly decompensate and they'll find themselves in an ICU needing a ventilator. But it usually revolves around the respiratory component of COVID-19.
Early on in COVID, there was just this panic for trying to have enough ventilators and getting enough ventilators. And then there was this back off from ventilators and that it was ultimate resort. Where are we at with ventilators?
You know, right now we're in a much better place than we were earlier on in the pandemic. There was this thought that, if we didn't do safer at home or if we didn't do the lockdown, that we would very quickly be overrun with COVID-19 patients. And the citizens of the state responded really well, better than I even thought that they would. And we didn't get overrun. And what that did is it gave us time to plan and acquire what we needed. So at UW Health and like all the other health systems, I'm sure in the state, we know exactly how many ventilators we have. We know how to reprocess things on a ventilator so that we can use it a little bit more efficiently. We even looked at anesthesia machines, the machines that we use to put people to sleep for surgery. Push comes to shove, we can use it as a ventilator. So we feel like we're in a lot better place with ventilators. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we'd hate to test this plan because any hospital is going to have some sort of max to the capacity that it has.
We're talking with UW Health Emergency Medicine Physician Jeff Potoff and Mark Rickers, who's been reporting on how public health tracks COVID recoveries. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about how public health tracks people who've recovered from COVID-19 and what recovered actually means. The recovery status from the Department of Health Services that we've been talking about, it stands at 59,076. or nearly 87% of confirmed cases in the recovered category, 86.6% to be exact. What do you think of how the state tracks coronavirus infections? What numbers are you following? Have you tested positive? When did you feel like you had recovered? Join in 800-642-1234. We have UW Health Chief Quality Officer Dr. Jeff Potthoff and WPR journalist Mark Rickers who stays with us. Let's take a call now. Don is joining us from Janesville. Hi, Don.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm a screener at one of the hospitals, and I feel really bad. And maybe he can touch base on this because I don't have a real clear thing. But I see these families coming in not feeling well, thinking they have COVID, spend $4,000 to $6,000 in the ER room and walk out without any treatment. And I understand there's no treatment, but I think these families and the news needs to let the people know that when you come into the ER, we're not going to do anything for you except for give you a $6,000 medical bill. I guess just some clarification on at what point will you be treated or not treated? So these people, you know, in a time when they aren't having jobs, they're not walking out with a $6,000 medical bill.
And Don, in certainly talking here about emergency room care, and I want to field this to Dr. Potthoff, what that triage looks like and what that care looks like in the emergency room setting, because emergency rooms are really costly.
Yeah, you're right. And this is actually a difficult thing that we struggle with because what we don't want to do is dissuade people who absolutely need to come to the emergency department from coming by saying it's expensive or that nothing's going to happen, because for that person, they might stay home and have just a really bad outcome. You know, I think in general, thinking about COVID in the emergency department, if you feel like you're just having symptoms that are closer to like a common cold. So, you know, I have some cough, I feel kind of tired, maybe I've got a headache. I don't have any special medicine in the emergency department to make you feel better. What I'll probably do is, you know, see if you're dehydrated. That's commonly associated with folks who have this. Maybe give you some fluids, but if you can drink water, you can take care of that. And then probably Tylenol or ibuprofen for the headache. The thing that I would caution people again against is if you are feeling short of breath and you're starting to get scared that you can't breathe good, at that point, it probably is really reasonable to come in and see us. And it's not so easy as like these are the numbers that you get admitted on and these are the numbers that you don't get admitted on. But there's a whole battery of tests we can do. We can monitor oxygen levels in the blood. Do chest x-rays, see how hard it is for you to breathe, that work of breathing, and taking all those factors together can determine whether we think it's okay for you to go home or if you need to come into the hospital.
Dr. Potthoff, I think we've seen here during COVID just how important it is to have primary care and to have nurse triage and other support systems to know when to take those steps. Are you seeing that in the virus?
You know, we do see that. I think, you know, one of the things that we are uncovering, or maybe not uncovering, we know it's been there, we're shining a light on it, is this idea that in the United States, it really has to do with whether or not you are lucky enough or you have the financial means to have health insurance. If you do, your ability to access these things, whether it's nurse triage, whether it's the emergency department, healthcare in general, it is much better versus in other countries where it doesn't really matter whether you have insurance or not. They have systems in place where everyone has access to a primary care provider and everyone has access to healthcare. So I think COVID has shown a light on that in the sense that people getting sick make the rest of us sick. So it just doesn't work for some of us to have access and not others. It affects all of us.
We're talking how the coronavirus recovery process works, how coronavirus patients recover differently from the disease, and how public health is tracking that. We're talking with Dr. Jeff Potthoff from UW Health and WPR digital producer Mark Rickers, taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234 about the recovery process. Let's bring in Tom now in Burlington with a question. Hi, Tom.
Does the way you breathe affect your ability to survive the disease? In other words, some people are shallow chest breathers and some people are deep belly breathers, and overweight people have a high mortality rate, it seems, because I think they don't have enough room to breathe. They're not getting the exchange that they should be getting.
Tom, thanks. Dr. Potoff, what about the way we breathe and this virus?
Yeah, Tom is onto something there. So not as so much like shallow breathers, deep breathers, but certainly we see worse disease in individuals who are obese. And we think what happens with that is coronavirus attacks the lungs. The lungs don't work as well. People who are obese, the lungs need to work harder because every breath you take that expands them has to work against additional weight. And that makes it harder for those people to breathe. They can even be harder to treat on a ventilator. So there is absolutely something there to, you know, how people breathe. Congruent with that is also people with underlying lung disease, you know, COPD, heart failure, even to some extent asthma. They don't do as well because they're already starting at a disadvantage when they get the disease.
Mark Rickers, what do researchers think might be affecting the speed and the difference of speed in how patients recover?
I don't think they know. Yeah. It's still kind of early days. You know, we're getting a lot of anecdotal reports in these patient groups, but the studies are still kind of coming in.
And with the long haulers, as they're called, are they still contagious if they have symptoms?
By most metrics, no. I mean, they all of the public health aspects of COVID are around infection. And as long as people are, you know, quarantined or isolated for 10 days, they're generally not going to be infectious to other people. It's just about recovering from those symptoms.
Dr. Potoff, why does the state use that 30-day benchmark to track whether someone is recovered?
Yeah, I think when you look at the state, like Mark said, they're really looking at infectivity. So can you infect other people or not? And they need to pick this point in time. So it needs to be, when you're looking at the data, it has to be this binary. Either you are or you aren't. Unfortunately, with COVID-19, you know, you might survive this acute phase. You might be alive at 30 days. But we have all this literature and all this data now that doesn't mean you're better. So I think we have to make sure we don't think of recovered as better. There are a lot of people who are not better after 30 days, and they're suffering from a lot of symptoms weeks, months afterwards.
What can happen if you have been on a ventilator for weeks or even some days? Are there side effects?
Yeah, so the ventilator, although it's a great tool to keep people alive, if you're on a ventilator, you're often sedated, you're paralyzed, your muscles don't get to work out. You really get weak. Everything about you gets weak. It's hard to have, you know, great nutrition. When you come off that ventilator, you're not ready to walk down the hall and go to the cafeteria. You are very weak. Many of these people can't go home. They have to go to nursing homes, rehab facilities, and it is a long journey to get back to where you were before you came in the hospital and were put on a ventilator.
Mark, what might be a better word than recovery to describe how the state is tracking infections?
I think Dr. Potoff actually gave it to me, which is recovering. It's people who are, you know, they're no longer an infection risk, but they are trying to nurse themselves back to health, whether that's under the care of medical professionals or under their own support network with people at home.
Dr. Potoff, what are you watching here as symptoms linger for months with some of these patients? What research is going to be really pivotal here on these long haulers?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a couple things. So there's people who have these symptoms, and that's worrisome, but we like to think one level deeper. So what might be long-term serious medical outcomes from COVID-19? And there is a couple studies out there that have us worried. There's one in JAMA Cardiology that says that people months after their battle with COVID have inflammation of their heart. That worries us that those people may be at risk for congestive heart failure, similar to people that have had heart attacks. We don't know if that's going to happen yet, but we have our eye on it. Likewise, in the journal Radiology, what radiologists are finding is that the pneumonia associated with COVID-19 is the same type of pneumonia that frequently scars our lungs. So those people with pneumonias that are like this sometimes have lifelong difficulty with their lungs, with shortness of breath. We don't know if that's going to hold true for COVID-19, but that pattern is there and it has us a little bit worried.
Mark Rickers, can you take us back to Adrienne Lathan? How is she doing today?
She is feeling better. She's working. She actually works for Milwaukee Public Schools, so she's helping get teachers set for the fall.
She's busy.
Yeah, she's definitely busy. You know, it's more about kind of taking that mental self-care, you know, and working through the feeling of loss. But she said when we spoke in July, she said she was still at about 80%. So she's still feeling a little bit run down, a little tired, a little difficulty breathing, but, you know, starting to get back to normal.
Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Anytime.
That was Dr. Jeff Potthoff, Chief Quality Officer for UW Health. Mark Rickers is digital producer for WPR's program To the Best of Our Knowledge. You can find his reporting at wiscontext.org. Coming up, we look at how the pandemic has disrupted our state's foster care system. That's coming up after a news update here on the Ideas Network. We're checking in on the foster care system here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The child welfare system is under stress due to the pandemic, but for the roughly 437,000 children in our country in foster care, this is an especially difficult time. And now there's a bill in Congress to suspend the timeline for terminating parental rights to help address a backlog of custody cases. Social workers, what are the biggest challenges facing the foster care system? How has the pandemic intensified these issues? Did you grow up in foster care? What about the system worked? What didn't? Join in at 800-642-1234. Social worker Johanna Barkai is with the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee, which supports the child welfare profession. Johanna, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Congresswoman Gwen Moore introduced legislation this month that would give parents more time to regain custody of their children in foster care. What do you see as necessary about this legislation right now?
I think the issue of having a timeline that parents are having to abide by, which is 15 months, which when you're dealing with some of the really significant issues that some of our families are, is not a lot of time. And so I think there is something important to looking at how much are families able to work towards reunification? Are they able to see their children in person or as often? Are they able to get the services that they need? How are they struggling with a lot of the other impacts that many of us are struggling with in this pandemic, but are intensified because of the other issues? And so the idea that both families, courts, and agencies would able to use more time, I think is an important thing to think about.
Is there a growing custody case backlog in the courts right now?
I think that the courts around the state and around the nation have tried to use Zoom, other kinds of technologies to try to keep some of the cases going. But I think some of those trials, especially jury trials, when some of those different kinds of court cases are contested, I think those have been a struggle to be able to keep up and to be able to have those trials occur as they would have been typically scheduled.
How has social distancing affected the visits between foster children and their biological families?
That is an issue that I am really concerned about. So when the pandemic first started, there was in some areas, visits were completely stopped in terms of in-person contact. So all of those visits switched to being by phone, via some kind of technology, with a video conferencing. And depending upon the age of the child, their needs, even the type of technology that the parent may have accessible to them, that was really, really difficult. I'm a parent and I cannot imagine not being able to see my child face to face for a month, 2 months, 3 months. So as the virus has continued on and the time frames have continued to get longer and longer, all the agencies really and the counties have made a concerted effort to try to get those face-to-face visits started again. But it's not the same when you're having to abide by all the social distancing rules, the anxiety that I think everyone involved feels, limitations on who might be able to come to those visits. It's really been a huge change, both for the parents who are trying to see their children, for the children who are in the foster care system, as well as for the foster parents who are caring for those children, who now may have additional behaviors, additional emotions and concerns and fears because they're not able to see their family in the same way that they would have prior to all of this.
Are you saying that a visit might have to be where the child is 6 feet away from their biological parent and they can't touch them during this visit, and they can visit, but they can't hold each other?
No, I mean, now that visits are happening in person, I believe some of the restrictions that they're looking at is having everyone wear a mask, unless obviously they're under 2 years old, trying to have visits outside instead of having visits inside, maybe not being able to have visits at the parents' home. Maybe that it would have to be in a setting that they could make sure had been sanitized, as well as there may be a family where extended family members came to some of those visits, and those family members might not be able to come. So while that child may be able to visit with their mother, with their father, they might not be able to visit with their grandparents or aunts and uncles. And again, that might depend upon, you know, case by case situations, different counties, those kinds of things. Because in the state of Wisconsin, every county does things a little bit differently. But yeah, so they are able to touch each other. I think, especially when you're dealing with small children, you could make that rule and I don't think anyone would follow it.
We're talking with Johanna Barkai, who is a social worker in Milwaukee. We're checking in on the foster care system amid the pandemic. You can join in. How has the coronavirus changed the foster care system? Join in with your insights. Did you grow up in foster care? What about the system worked? What didn't? How do you want lawmakers to change or improve the way the foster care system works in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. Johanna, what sort of circumstances lead to a child being placed in foster care?
There can be a lot of different reasons why a child might be placed in foster care. The number one reason that children, both in Wisconsin and nationwide, end up in foster care is due to neglect. So that would be some kind of inability or unwillingness to provide for the basic needs of a child. Then we also have instances where it could be physical abuse. There could be sexual abuse, but as I said, primarily it ends up being neglect. That's the number one reason why children enter into the foster care system, which is part of the reason why the conditions of the pandemic are so significant to what we are seeing with playing out with families on a day-to-day basis.
Can you tell us more specifically what you mean by that? How is the pandemic affecting placement?
So right now we have some good news, and the good news is that what we call referrals, so those calls that come in reporting abuse and neglect, are down. There's lots of speculation about why that may be occurring. But that right now is a positive thing. What may be going on behind the scenes is a different concern. But when we're thinking about the conditions that families that are either already involved in the foster care system or might be at risk of being involved in the foster care system When you're dealing with economic hardships, when you're dealing with housing insecurity, social isolation, potentially increased rates of domestic violence, all of those things make it harder to be able to parent your children safely, to be able to manage your own behaviors, and to be able to be a safe and successful parent, which I think those of us who are parents who are living through this time can relate that even without safety concerns, I think everyone is struggling in ways that they never imagined that they would be faced with as in their role as a parent.
And so you're saying there are all of these compounding issues from, you know, from food and shelter and from economic joblessness that can all affect how a child is cared for.
Yes, as well as if a parent has their children already in foster care, could impact their ability to be able to get those children home. So whether it derailed some of their other treatment progress that they may have been making, kind of dealing through past significant trauma is not easy when you don't know if you're going to have enough to eat, if you don't know where you're going to sleep tonight. And it may also make it harder for a child to just come home. If you maybe were planning to have that child return home within the next 30 days, and now that parent loses their housing. And now there isn't a home for that child to return to. And maybe situations like going to a homeless shelter may not be an option in the same way because of those concerns with social distancing and the possible spread of COVID.
So circling back to the legislation on parental rights, what happens if that's not passed, if there isn't support for passing that? How would that affect families?
So it's in some ways it's difficult to say because there are exceptions that are built into the federal law that should allow for some ability to use discretion to extend some of those timelines. So I think the concern that Representative Moore had in introducing this bill was one, will everyone use that discretion when they should? Will they know how? Will they know which situations to be able to identify as being appropriate to have those timelines be extended? In addition, there are financial ties that occur that if the states do not follow those timelines and are not adequately documenting their efforts, they may lose federal funding as well.
Social worker Joanna Barkai is with us from the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. We're checking in on the foster care system amid the pandemic. How do you want lawmakers to change or improve the way foster care works in Wisconsin? Teachers, what are you concerned about as the school year starts with virtual learning? Social workers, are you seeing a custody case issues in the pandemic? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Joanna Barkai here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with social worker Joanna Barkai with the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. We're learning about the foster care system, how the pandemic has affected family reunification cases. Joanna, what about the 18,000 or roughly, you know, U.S. teenagers who age out of the foster care system each year? What happens to them here in the pandemic because they have never become really part of a permanent family?
Absolutely. This is a population that struggles extremely even during the best of times. And so during this time period, this is the population that even if they were employed, they may have lost their jobs because this is the group that may be, you know, working some of those retail and service jobs that we know has really been devastated by unemployment. These are also youth that really need a lot of that support and may not have a lot of those healthy informal support networks to assist them. And so now they're going to be even more isolated. Some of these youth may be enrolled in college. And as dorms have closed or there's a question of whether dorms will be able to stay open, that has really limited people's ability to have stable housing. Typically, when a child or an adult, actually, who's in college, if they close the dorm, they return to their parents' home. But these youth don't necessarily have a home to return to.
Just to be clear, what age do you age out in Wisconsin in foster care?
We do have a law that has allowed us to extend foster care up until the age of 21.
Okay.
Not every child qualifies for that or chooses that option. Otherwise, children age out somewhere between 18 and 19. So I think with the pandemic, there really has been a push to get as many youth as possible to qualify till that age 21. As well as there's been other legislation that has been introduced nationally to say anyone who is currently involved in the child welfare system, even if they're approaching that 21, should be able to stay within the system and continue to receive support. But that's, again, another legislation that's pending and hasn't been enacted yet.
Has the pandemic changed the way we approach the child welfare system? Has legislation like this been a long time coming and the pandemic just pushed us over?
I think that the pandemic has force people to think about things differently. So the type of legislation that is coming out, some of it is very focused into what's currently going on, but it is having people really think about how does the world around us impact what's going on with child welfare? How do we have more flexibility, more support to really understand how vulnerable everybody who is involved in this system really is? What I do hope to see out of this is that some of this time to think, to reimagine, may hopefully lead to some better outcomes overall. That maybe some of the things that we always said, this is just the way things are, there aren't other options. This time of pressure, but also creativity, will hopefully lead people towards creating a system that's more accessible, has a greater social safety net, so that we have an ability to withstand unexpected things as well as kind of the innovation to the future.
What do better outcomes look like in the foster care system in particular?
Better outcomes, I think, first of all, is we always hope that we're able to reunify more children and have them remain safe in their homes. And actually, even before then, true better outcomes in child welfare is preventing children from being removed from their homes in the first place. So we always want to be able to provide as much preventative services and support so that children never have to leave their parents' home, because we know how traumatic that is for children and families. But once children do enter the system into out-of-home care, we hope that they're either able to go home or reach some other kind of permanency as quickly as possible.
We're talking with Johanna Barkai, who works for the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. We're checking in on the foster care system and child welfare amid the pandemic, taking your questions, your insights, and your experiences, 800-642-1234. Johanna, Attorney General Josh Call and nearly two dozen other attorneys general, they recently filed a brief with the Supreme Court supporting the rights of same-sex couples to be foster parents. How big of an issue is this in Wisconsin?
So we are lucky in Wisconsin that this has not been an issue for a number of years. So here in Wisconsin, same-sex couples are able to foster and adopt with the institution of same-sex marriage. Now parents are able to adopt. Prior to that, it might be one parent who is able to adopt, but not a second legally unrelated adult. So I think part of the reason why Attorney General Call signed into this brief was really to support how important it is to have those non-discrimination laws, and to say that if a government contractor, which is what happened in this case, says we are unable or unwilling to license same-sex couples because it's against our beliefs, then they shouldn't be having that contract then. They can do all sorts of other kinds of services. They can operate privately. But if the government is paying an agency to fulfill a responsibility, then that should be done without discrimination and be equal access to everyone.
Johanna, is it difficult to find foster families now? Do you have enough for the children who do need to be placed?
That has been a real struggle. As the opioid crisis has increased, many, many counties are struggling in having enough foster homes to be able to care for all the children who are coming into the foster care system, as well as to be able to make good matches. We don't just want homes. We want to be able to have enough selection to be able to make sure that the family is best suited for the child and that child's needs, as well as to be able to keep sibling groups together. So the pandemic just increases that struggle to be able to find new foster homes or find foster homes that might be willing to accept new placements in the middle of all of this kind of chaos and uncertainty.
You mentioned the opioid crisis. How is that affecting child welfare?
There has been an increase in regards to the number of children who are really being impacted by this opioid crisis. The positive news is that I think Wisconsin has really tried to make sure that our numbers of children in out-of-home care have not exploded, whereas that has happened in other areas. But I think we've really, really tried to keep those numbers down, put in those supports. But it has been very, very difficult for a lot of families. And, you know, we've seen overdose deaths, which is always just extremely traumatic for everyone involved.
In the last few seconds, you know, child welfare and the social work that you do can be so stressful and really difficult. How do you stay hopeful and optimistic?
That's a great question. I think you have to really be thinking about what you're doing and why. What does it mean to you? What does it mean to the families that you're working with? You know, how can you make a difference to others? And at the same time, remembering to take care of yourself, because it's very difficult to give to others when you don't have those internal resources for yourself.
Johanna, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Johanna Barkai is a social worker with the Helen Bader School of Social Work at UW-Milwaukee. Just ahead, we have a recap of the Democratic National Convention. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.